The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Bonjour, hi, Canada. And to our Jewish friends observing Yom Kippur, may you have an easy fast today. My first story comes from Israel, where it is shut down, but its Israeli defense forces remain on very high alert after rockets and various incidents along the southern and northern border occurred. Accountability. Some accountability for the Afghanistan debacle has come along. But not in the United States, where Joe Biden continues to hide from that. In Great Britain, Boris Johnson sacked his equivalent of Tony Blinken. Dominic Raab has been fired. And a new Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, has been named to the office. Raab was blamed for leaving thousands of British allies behind in Afghanistan to the brutality of the Taliban. He also made a number of other changes as one of his ministers leaks. They're ready to go for an early election in Great Britain, but Afghanistan remains a killing ground. President Biden is demolishing Trump's Middle East triumph, according to the lead Con Collin defense editor at Great Britain's The Telegraph. The Abraham Accords are at risk thanks to the view in the Arab world that the U.S. can no longer be trusted. Another fallout from Afghanistan. There is one bit of good news in the national security front this morning. The U.S., the U.K., and Australia signed a pact yesterday. It's called AUKUS, A-U-K-U-S. Maybe it's A-U-K-U-S. Maybe it's AUKUS. I don't know how they pronounce it. I think it'll be AUKUS. The Down Under Aussies are going to join the Brits and the Americans in a nuclear submarine program. They'd previously been buying conventional submarines from the French, which aren't good enough against China. So over the course of a year and a half, they'll figure out how to expand the Australian fleet by 8 nuclear submarines with cruise missiles, adding to the deterrent of an expanding China. Now, the big story in Washington, D.C., and it really did grip the city yesterday, is what did General Milley say and to whom did he say it after the new Woodward and Costa book, Peril, has appeared? The White House stepped forward to defend General Milley against charges he did anything inappropriate. Editorials in the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal both call for instant investigations and hearings under oath of General Milley for fear that he has compromised not merely American defense in his conversations with China, but the constitutional order. Now, I have said from the beginning, 2 days ago, hold your fire on this, wait and see. Acting Secretary of Defense Miller, who had replaced Mark Esper at the time of the second call, says he did not authorize the call, and that's extraordinary and a cause for resignation. Mike Pompeo went on Fox with Hannity last night and made some comments on this, which you ought to hear. Here's Secretary Pompeo, cut number one.
I have no recollection of a conversation like that. Look, we were all pretty down. We were about to hand over the reins of foreign policy to what this administration, we've seen these last 8 months, what that means for the United States of America. So if someone asked, was I excited about January 20th and the fact that we were no longer going to have the capacity to secure American freedom, I count me for being a pretty dark place, too. But what's important to know, Sean, is, you know, all this has as a predicate this idea that somehow there was this fear. There was a cabinet members running around concerned that Donald Trump was going to engage in some kind of rogue activity or some kind of act of war to sort of lash out. This never happened. It's just patently absurd. And so the entire predicate for all of this assessment that Woodward has now laid out in his book, we'll see what turns out. But make no mistake about it, during that entire time, the entire time I served, all 4 years, we conducted orderly foreign policy. We had a national security team that was working hard to make sure that we made the best decisions we possibly could. And I think the data set would show that we did a pretty damn effective job in doing that.
The allegation that is floating around Washington is that a group of senior officials formed a guardrail around Donald Trump as he became erratic after the election. I know there was great consultation among the national security team because of a series of initiatives taken against China after the election before the transition, including and leading to the declaration of China's involvement in genocide against the Uyghurs. But close consultation, you can call whatever you want, close consultation, the left is calling it guardrails, but this does not go to whether or not General Milley ought to have been talking to China. Pompeo continued, cut number two.
Unconstitutional, incomprehensible, and completely out of line for any military leader, certainly someone who's in the role that the chief of staff is in. You've described it, Greg Jarrett described it too. He's just simply an advisor. He's not in the chain of command for operational activity. So this would be dangerous and an usurpation of authority that is historically anomalous, and we should make sure.
I'd stop right there. If it happened. And to that end, Tom Cotton said this, cut number five. No. Tom Cotton is cut number six.
Brian, I know he will address it and will ensure that he addresses it. But this is one of those claims, obviously, that seems a little far-fetched, the idea that an American military general is going to warn an adversary if an attack is coming. As you say, when Donald Trump was never even thinking about a military attack against China, the whole thing is pretty far-fetched. I will say this, though. That book also reports what's been widely reported, what we've heard in Congress just over the last 2 days in testimony from intelligence officers and senior military officers, that Joe Biden disregarded the military advice he received earlier this year about what would happen if he went forward with his disastrous withdrawal from Afghanistan. And we ought not to forget that. We ought not be distracted by that ongoing fiasco for which there's so much work still to be done.
Sure. Jennifer.
Tom Cotton is very right. We've got to learn more about this. We've got to be much more specific about what happened before we jump to a conclusion. Admiral Kirby, the retired Navy admiral, who's the spokesperson at the Pentagon, simply said this about General Milley, cut number four.
Again, I can't speak to the validity, but I see nothing in what I've read that would cause any concern.
That's just flacking. Here's President Biden at the White House, cut number five.
Come on, guys. Sir, did General Milley do the right thing, sir?
Thank you. Let's go. Thank you. Thank you.
General Milley do the right thing.
I have great confidence in General Milley.
That's the only answer at this point. But John Kennedy, senator from Louisiana, was on with Laura Ingraham last night, cut number 11.
Well, first, Laura, just one point of view. Roses are red. Political love is fake. Washington weddings are just funerals with cake. I know President Biden has said he will stand behind and stands behind General Milley. And maybe that's true for the short term. But I'm going to give you even odds that eventually the White House throws him under the bus, because the White House desperately needs someone besides President Biden on which to blame the stunning incompetence in Afghanistan.
There, I think Senator Kennedy is absolutely right. Other stories this morning, U.S. booster policy is in flux because it's the Biden administration and nothing works in the Biden administration. How hard is it to say boosters are available 8 months after you had your last one? But the FDA says, we're not sure. They're using them in Israel to great effect. They ought to be available here to anyone who wants. John Durham has been heard from, the special prosecutor investigating the dossier gate, said it to be about ready to indict a lawyer, Michael Sussman, maybe charged with lying to the FBI in September of 2016. Can you believe it's taken us five years to get to an indictment for someone that led the FBI had a merry chase that crippled the Trump administration from the beginning. Democrats are moving forward with their budget package to really sock you with taxes. They don't care what it's going to do to you or to the economy. Border authorities announced that they detained 200,000 migrants, illegal migrants, in August, second consecutive month above 200,000. So, by the way, when you hear Democrats claiming they had an extraordinary success in getting 125,000 Afghans out of Kabul, understand that in the 2 months at the border, July and August, they let in 400,000 people that did not have the same claim to having relied upon American promises. France has killed an ISIS leader responsible for the death of four U.S. soldiers. We appreciate that. The top Islamic State militant in Niger. Simone Biles' testimony yesterday about the abuse that she and her former gymnastic teammate suffered by the villain Lawrence Nassar ought to have been detected by the FBI. Various people are reading various things into Gavin Newsom's overwhelming win in California. I'm here to tell you, if you spend that much money in turning out your union vote in California, it's going to stay blue. And in fact, James Homan of the Washington Post wrote today, "National Democrats would be foolish to read much into California recall victory." He's correct. Gavin Newsom is back in charge of that state, and wildfires are close to Sequoia National Park, one of the most beautiful places I've ever been, where the great and oldest giant trees on planet Earth are now threatened. Again, when fires rage, the governor is responsible. Newly confirmed in his office, Gavin Newsom has yet another disaster to deal with. I'll be right back after the break. That's the rundown on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I talk about ReliefFactor.com. Great sponsor of the program. There it is. My time in the morning to take it when I do, every hour in the first hour of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Make sure I take my sponsor's product, not because they're my sponsor, but because it works. ReliefFactor.com. Yesterday I took it. I was out for 6 miles. And, I always listen. I have 4 podcasts that I pay for. Buckeye Talk from Cleveland.com, the College Football Playoff Podcast, the Orange and Brown Talk, and Civilized Barking. I pay for those 4 podcasts. But I got to walk at least 6 miles to listen to them all, and that's why I take ReliefFactor.com, because otherwise I'm wasting all the money that I otherwise spend to use if I don't use my exercise time, which is why you need to use ReliefFactor.com. Stay tuned. Somewhere beyond the sea. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined now by, and you know from the music, Admiral James Stavridis. He is retired United States Navy, former Allied Supreme Commander of NATO, former head of Southern Command, good friend of the show. Good morning, Admiral. How are you?
Doing great, Hugh. Big day down under in Australia.
That's my second of 3 issues in degree of difficulty. I'm going to talk about Afghans, Aussies, and General Milley. Let me start with Afghans. I know a lot of people who've served in Afghanistan, but none of them from your perspective. Axios reports 37,000 Afghan refugees are coming in your state of Florida. You'll get 1,000. Mississippi's getting 10. North Dakota's getting 49. Ohio's getting 855. I pointed out America has between 300 and 400,000 churches. We can absorb 37,000 Afghans. And people ask me, well, what are they like? I actually don't know. So I thought I'd ask you, what do you think we'll find among our new Americans?
Well, let me start by saying in my beloved state of Florida, I'd be happy to get 5,000. These are hardworking people. And let me tell you something, Hugh. We know in Florida about people who flee persecution. They were called Cubans. They came here and built an extraordinary community in South Florida. The Cuban Americans helped build this state in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and today are a vibrant part of it. I expect nothing less from the Afghans. And let me tell you, it's not just what are Afghans like. It's what are these Afghan like. And so there I would say to you, hey, how much courage and true grit and determination does it take to put your 2-year-old on your back, grab your 4-year-old's hand, picture yourself in this situation, fight your way through those crowds, get through that airport, and get a ride out and finally make it here? I want that person on my team. It's like the Hunger Games. So they are, in my long association with Afghans, warm, charming, friendly, funny, hardworking. It is going to be nothing but a plus up for this nation of immigrants. I would say let's take all the Afghans we can get. And I'll close, Hugh. You and I are both young enough to remember the arrival of the Vietnamese American community. Hello, California. Do you think that's been a plus up for the Golden State? I certainly do.
I mentioned that earlier. My Roman Catholic parish in Ohio adopted a Vietnamese family refugee in the 70s, great members of the community. They weren't Catholic. And I just think America's faith communities will step up. Second, the Aussies. Big news. And, you know, in a month of dark news, tell me what you think about the new deal between, or the AUKUS, I guess it's being called.
Yeah, it's kind of a goofy acronym, AUKUS, but it's Australia, UK, and the United States. Couldn't be a closer set of nations. You know, for the United States, if you look at our historical associations, obviously with Great Britain, but really look at Australia, Hugh. They have stood with us in combat in every conflict the United States has been in, every single one. Vietnam, Korea, Gulf Wars, the current forever wars stretching back to World War I. It is a nation with whom we share a lot in common, a kind of a frontier spirit. We are very lucky to have them on the team. So to bring those three nations together who collectively have immense technology, no language barriers, shared value systems is very powerful. The key, and this was President Biden yesterday talking about this new alignment, but the real key is nuclear submarine technology. I want to make sure people understand this is not nuclear weapons. The Australians have no desire to operate nuclear weapons. We don't want them to. We don't want to have further proliferation, even to our allies, of nuclear weapons. But this is nuclear-powered submarines. It'll help balance the rise of China. It is nothing but good, in my view.
Now, I hope I reported this correctly. I believe they'll be armed with hypersonic missiles. Am I correct about that?
I think that's a good bet. They'll come out of vertical launch tubes. I predict this boat, and no one knows exactly what it's going to look like. We call submarines boats in the Navy. I predict this boat will have vertical launch, Tomahawk-like capability, but it'll be built from the ground floor up to carry hypersonics.
And so it's basically, if you take the three fleets, are we capable of containing the Chinese underwater fleet?
We are. This will be extremely helpful because it will ensure that the Chinese have to keep in mind these Australian nuclear-powered attack boats. And these nuclear-powered attack boats, you know, we used to say in warfare that infantry was the queen of the battlefield, not referring to femininity, but referring to the powers of the chess piece. The queen on the board can go anywhere and do anything. Submarines are the queen of the undersea battlefield.
Now, let's turn to General Milley. And I have said only this. We have to know what happened because I don't know what happened. I've seen the reports of peril. The Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post editorialized the same. Talk to me about your general reactions, your suspicions, and the context that may or may not be missing. And if indeed it's simply a rogue call by a panicked general, which I find hard to believe, what would happen?
Let's start with something general, which is General Milley, Mark Milley. I know him extremely well. Almost 20 years ago, I picked him when he was a colonel and I was a three-star admiral to become the briefer with Don Rumsfeld in the Pentagon, because nobody else in the Pentagon could hang with Don Rumsfeld and explain what we were trying to do in those days in deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. He is tough in the clutch. He's smart, Princeton graduate, captain of the hockey team. He looks like a bouncer in a bar. That kind of covers up a very sharp, razor sharp mind. He worked for me in Afghanistan as a general. He is a combat warfighter to the nth degree. So he's the whole package in terms of the military. That's a context that I think a lot of people are missing. Number two, more importantly to this situation, everything that I can see, and I haven't even read the book, but what I can see reported looks to me like Chairman of the Joint Chiefs 101. This is what he's supposed to do. He's supposed to call certainly our allied contemporaries, call the head of the British Armed Forces, the French Armed Forces, the German Armed Forces, the Japanese Armed Forces. He is also supposed to have open ability to talk to the head of the Russian Armed Forces, Chinese Armed Forces. I would love it if he could talk to the head of the Iranian Armed Forces and the North Korean Armed Forces, because that's how you deconflict. That's how you avoid rising tensions. Now, having said all of that, I see Tom Cotton has taken a pretty balanced stance here and said, look, that call was monitored by a dozen people. Probably there might even be a transcript or a recording. Let's take a look at it in a classified setting and see what the general said. So when I roll all that together, I'm quite confident Mark Milley is on the right side of this one.
Now, the acting Secretary of Defense at the time, Miller, has said he did not authorize the call. Could someone else have authorized the call and still, if it includes what Woodward and Costas say it includes, a warning that we would not use any attacks or any aggression? The one thing I've heard of greatest concern is that at the time the second call happened, we had more than 150 actions unfolding against China, including the declaration of their status as a genocidal country, and that there was no Deputy National Security Pottinger, no Assistant Secretary of State Stillwell, General Stillwell, who I'm sure you know as well, on the call, which would make it out of the norm. Is your mind open to finding out that after the stresses of the last 6 months of the tenure of Donald Trump, the general broke the rules and would have to resign?
I'm always open to any official having to place his or her conduct against written rules. No problem. And I'm sure General Milley would tell you the same thing if you were on the show. What I will tell you is, as Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, if I wanted to pick up the phone and call the Supreme Commander of the Russian Armed Forces, General Nikolai Makarov, I picked up the phone and I called him in order to deconflict things in operations everywhere from counter-piracy in the Persian Gulf to things we were doing in northern Afghanistan. Again, it's Chairman 101 in my view. Having said that, again, if there's a transcript, run it against the rule set. Maybe there's a different policy now than there was when I was Supreme Allied Commander. But from all I know and all I can see, I find it unlikely, highly unlikely, that Chairman Milley departed from his remit.
You know, I think I'm going to take that and use that as a close, Admiral. Run it against his rule set. Find out what happened. Run it against his rule set. And I think that's an excellent piece of advice. James Stavridis, congratulations again on 2034, which continues to sell, but it's not in the background. Oh, there it is. Okay, there it is in the picture. Never take it down, Admiral. Never take it down.
Until the sequel comes out. I'm giving you news this morning. We signed a two-book contract for a sequel, 2054 and 2074, which will take the storyline and the surviving characters deep into the 21st century, dealing with artificial intelligence and climate.
Deadlines?
Stay tuned.
When's the deadline? When's it going to drop?
The second volume, 2054, will be out in about a year, year and a half.
Good for you and Elliot Ackerman. Thank you, Admiral. Be well. Time for me to talk about our sponsor, AndrewandTodd.com, and give you a market update. Andrew and Todd help you borrow money if you want to go move to Florida and buy a second home. AndrewandTodd.com with Sierra Pacific Mortgage, 888-888-1172. They send you money after you apply for it, and they approve you. And if you're trying to buy a home, they'll give you a pre-qualification letter. The 10-year Treasury yesterday, in a green day for the markets all around, went up to 1.304%. It was down to 1.277 yesterday. I hope you called Andrew and Todd yesterday at 888-888-1172. You will have gotten a better rate locked in. But it won't have increased but a couple of bucks a month between yesterday and today. I can't say that about next month or 6 months from now or a year from now. I think inflation is coming to these rates. And so do not wait another day. Yesterday, the Dow was up 236 points. The S&P up 37. The NASDAQ up 123. Overseas today, everything is up, including 1% jump in France and 0.5% in England and almost 0.5% in Germany at this hour. And I'll tell you, we don't know what will happen in the markets today, but I know that housing is cheap right now. But you got to go to AndrewandTodd.com, 888-888-1172. Welcome back, America. Jim Talent, former senator from Missouri, is part of the Bipartisan Policy Center. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
Well, I'm fine. How are you?
Good. Concerned but measured. I have taken the position of wait and see on General Milley. I am wondering what you see and think about that controversy.
I think it's very responsible to wait and see because we don't know what he said and we don't know what the context was. Now, I was just listening to Admiral Stav, and he mentioned that when he was Supreme Allied Commander, he did a lot of deconfliction. See, the question I would ask, and I think people like Cotton are going to ask, is the admiral was in the operational chain of command, and Milley is not.
And so I should have asked that.
He doesn't have direct responsibility for this. Now, if he's doing it as part of an effort that includes and is signed off on by those who are in the operational chain of command, that's an entirely different thing. So I think the question is, did Mark Esper or the acting approve this? If they did, it's a whole different kettle of fish. And I think it shows, I really like Tom Cotton, and I think it shows Tom's judgment that he's saying, let's see what happened. This could be fine, it could be questionable, or it could be really bad. And
do you agree with me that the number of people in the room does not matter? I'm seeing now in General Milley's defense, people are saying a dozen people are on the call. That doesn't matter. What matters is who the dozen people are. You agree with me about that?
Absolutely. I mean, did he have authorization, either specifically, or was this within his general, as the Admiral said, was this within the general guidelines within which he was free to exercise his discretion? But the chairman calls, I mean, he's an advisor, very important advisor, but he's an advisor to the president and to the secretary. He can pick up the phone and call anybody in the Pentagon he wants to get information. But when he starts calling foreign military leaders, it needs to be done with the approval of the statutory officers who have the authority and the accountability. So I think we have to see whether that's the case here. And then also, what was the message he was sending, the specific, the substantive message, and was he authorized to send that?
Now, what I have heard from senior members of the Trump administration is that neither the Deputy National Security Advisor, Matt Pottinger, the in-house expert on China, nor the National Security Advisor, O'Brien, nor General Stilwell from State, the Secretary, Assistant Secretary of East Asian Affairs, nor the Secretary of State, were on the call, and that the interagency was not respected. If that is true, does that ipso facto say the general was in the wrong?
Well, you didn't mention the Secretary of Defense. So, I mean, my reaction if I was sitting on the SAS was if he was authorized to do this by the Secretary, then the issue is did the Secretary act outside of instructions from the White House and from the established process, okay? But, yeah, I mean, this should have been something as significant as this should have been briefed up and approved, and I would think by an interagency process. There are just so many questions that we don't know, and we have to get to the bottom of. Now
Senator, I got to quickly ask this, because the Pentagon baffles me, and I've been in the Puzzle Palace, as other people call it, different things, 1,000 times. I still don't understand the difference between the deputy and the under. Is there anybody else besides the acting secretary, who at that time is acting Secretary Miller, who could have authorized the phone call in the chain of command? Is the deputy
potentially, I would think the under for policy it could have done it. But I would think something on this level would be the secretary of the DEPSEC. The DEPSEC basically can act. I mean, it's an unusual situation. The DEPSEC can and does act as the secretary in a lot of instances where you wouldn't see that with other agencies. So it just depends on how the secretary wants to do it. Some of the secretaries use the DEPSEC as basically alter egos. Okay,
but there are circumstances where it would be entirely appropriate, and there are circumstances where it would be wholly unconstitutional. Agree?
Yeah. Whether unconstitutional or outside of his statutory authority and accountability. And if that's the case, then we've got a big problem. In other words, if he was panicking because of some conclusions he was drawing about the election and decided he was going to save the republic and just pick up the phone and call his old friend over in China, yeah, that's a problem. He doesn't get to do that.
That's what I want to ask. If, in fact, you think that the Chinese are getting terrible intel and that they might be risking an aggression in anticipation of attack, what would you do if you're the chairman of the Joint Chiefs? I think you should call the National Security Advisor, I think, or the Secretary of Defense.
That's exactly right. You call people in Washington, and you apprise them of whatever intelligence you may have through your back channels that you've established over the years, and you work this process up. In other words, you let the people who have the authority have some input into what you're doing. Now, he may have done that, and Stab seems to be very confident that Milley would not have panicked or acted outside of his authority, and I take what the Admiral says very highly. So this is another reason to see what this was, what actually happened. You'd know more than I. You've read more of Woodward's books than I have.
Last question for you. There's a It's October and then it's January. Is it possible there is a standing quarterly call between these two people, in which case it would be ordinary and normal?
Yeah, it's possible, but I think that's probably unlikely.
All right. We will wait and see. Jim Talent says wait and see. I say wait and see. Tom Cotton says wait and see. We will wait and see. Hour number three, for those of you who will wait and see, straight ahead on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Hi, it's Hugh Hewitt for Birch Gold. If you found yourself completely befuddled by events in Afghanistan, alarmed about inflation and otherwise uneasy, well, about everything, about Americans standing in the world, about what comes next, then you're feeling like everybody else is, and uncertainty is usually a time that you want to increase your holdings in gold. When I do that, I do it with Birch Gold. I buy my gold from Birch Gold. You can go to HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, H-U-G-H, to 474747. They will send you free information. If you want to roll over a portion of your IRA or your 401k into physical precious metals, Birch Gold is who to do that with. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau, countless five-star reviews, thousands of happy customers. If you're thinking, I got to get some gold, do it with Birch Gold via HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, to 474747. That's Hugh to 474747 or HughGold.com. And that's a good question to follow up on. Jerry in Northern Virginia. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning, Hugh. Hey, I wanted to talk to you about these Australian submarines and just how big this is. You know, we don't share submarine technology with just anyone. I mean, our main partner has been Great Britain. We did some sharing with the French when they wanted to get into ballistic missile submarines. And so the idea that we've reached out and made this agreement is big strategically, and it's going to make the Chinese set up and really take notice. I think there will be a complication in that another member of the Quad, India, would really like to have access to U.S. submarine technology as well and has been talking to us for years about it. And they'll go, hey, what about us? But I think this is a great move. It's an expensive move. It's a long-term move, and the Australians are going to have a heavy burden. But this is something that can change the balance in the Western Pacific.
I am talking to Captain Jerry Hendricks, retired navalist and historian. So I got to ask you, Jerry, I might even ask you to stay over the break. How long does it take from agreement and concept to get a boat in the water?
You're looking at the early 2030s at the earliest right now, sometime probably 31, 32, in order to get a boat in the water from this time. If the agreement is solid and we have a design kind of go on, this is not an insubstantial effort to get this type of activity created industrially in Australia, which is where they want to do this. So it's going to be a long-term thing, but it is something that we can begin the sharing of information now.
Now, why, my last caller from Canada, why isn't Canada doing this?
It's a great question. In fact, I heard that, and that's one of the reasons I pick up the phone to call you. It would be great if the Canadians did come on board, but, you know, right now the Canadians are only committing about 1.14% of its GDP towards its defense budget. And if they would do this, they're going to need to meet their 2%, in fact, try to go closer to 3% to be able to afford this. You know, one of the things about this is Australia's only got a population of like 35 million. And so the idea of creating a tax base to support this type of activity, it's a huge lift for the Australians.
Don't go anywhere. Captain Jerry Hendricks, author of, what's the new book called, Jerry?
To Provide and Maintain a Navy.
To Provide and Maintain a Navy. We talked about it. Go get it, America. When we come back, we'll talk about this sub thing because it's a big story. Don't go anywhere. It's Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. One bit of good news in a very dark month is that America, the United Kingdom, and now Australia have agreed to combine on the sharing of nuclear submarine technology, nuclear propulsion, not nuclear weapons. Captain Jerry Hendricks, retired United States Navy historian, and Dr. Hendricks has written a book, To Provide and Maintain, which is, I think, on the desk of every member of the House Armed Services Committee. Captain, a couple more questions on this deal. When do you think we began to discuss this, and how angry are the French that they got booted out?
Well, I mean, I've been hearing conversations about this for a number of years. This has actually been somewhat viewed as a pipe dream in the past. So I was surprised yesterday and delighted when I saw the news at the same time, because the Australians just own the most critical piece of geography, you know, in the Western Pacific. It's, you know, it's a continent. It's ideally placed, you know, in this current great power competition we find ourselves in. And so to see them coming on as a partner in this key area of technology, undersea warfare and submarines and nuclear-powered submarines, it's just fantastic news. With regard to the French, I mean, I've seen the statements that have been published at just how angry the French are right now to, that Australia withdrew from the deal that they had with France, and that, two, that France isn't part of this sharing agreement as well. And it's very clear that they're upset and that they desire to be part of this agreement and to be part of this technology sharing. And I think that's something that we're going to have to take up and discuss with our allies going forward. But to circle back to your other point, you know, the Canadians have, you know, 8 million more people than Australia. You know, Canada is 35 million. Australia is at 25 million. And so if you look at the tax and industrial base, you would think that the Canadians could afford to actually get into this deal as well. And that would be great for us, that the idea with the Canadians being a Pacific-facing power as well, that they would actually have a submarine that could actually transit the Pacific. Right now, their diesel submarines are limited in their range, more ideally suited for Atlantic operations than Pacific operations. And it would be good if the Canadian allies to our north actually came on board with this as well.
So my last question, Captain Hendrick, is what does a nuclear attack submarine bring to the table in terms of deterrent power?
Well, it has the ability to interdict at incredible range an enemy's surface traffic as well as its subsurface traffic. You know, when we converted the USS Nautilus over to be nuclear powered in the mid-1950s, we very quickly came to understand that submarines are the ideal asset for hunting other submarines because they exist in that water column. They've got great sensors so they can hear at good distances. And so this really sort of changes things, specifically given sort of how old the designs are of the Chinese submarines. This would give an even greater threat and ability to monitor Chinese naval operations. So it's significant to see an ally like Australia coming on board with this. And quite frankly, if the Japanese weren't so sort of negative with nuclear power with their military, I would expect that they would be looking at this as well, given their location.
Well, given the inevitable ability to contain or necessity to contain China, don't we eventually see Japan and India with the same technology on the same mission using the same instruments of deterrence?
Well, I see India. India definitely wants a nuclear power. In fact, has nuclear power. They just don't have the best. They want to have access to American technology because when it comes to safety records as well as quieting and lethality, American submarines are the best in the world, bar none. Now, the Japanese can make an argument that because of their geostrategic location, they don't need a long-range submarine. They can stay with diesels because they're really just off China's coast, and so diesel can supply them with their security needs. But I would like to see them aligned technologically with us at all levels.
Jerry, thank you. It's great to talk to you, to provide and maintain. JR, retired military in San Antonio. Go ahead, JR.
Yes, my question was, when you were talking to the Admiral, he said he's had a lot of those conversations, but I would like to know, has he ever started any of those conversations with our Commander-in-Chief is crazy? Because, you know, after that, everything is insubordination. If you start to, and that's the context that's being reported. I haven't read the book, but everything I've heard is that is how he started the conversation.
I agree. That's why the transcript matters a lot. A lot. And that's what I'm going to ask Senator Cotton exactly about, JR. Thank you for your service. Stay tuned. I'm going to ask Tom Cotton exactly that question. If he says anything deprecatory about the Commander-in-Chief in this call, is he out? Stay tuned, America.
Hear the latest reporting and analysis on the big stories of the day on the Daybreak Insider podcast. It's top-notch reporting from SRN News, along with the sharpest insight from Hugh Hewitt, Mike Gallagher, Dennis Prager, Sebastian Gorka, and the voices of townhall.com. The Daybreak Insider podcast. It's your first look at today's top stories. Available at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, and at salempodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining me on this Thursday morning. Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas is my guest. Good morning, Senator. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning, Hugh. It's good to be on with you as always.
I've got a lot of things to cover. I'm going to begin perhaps counterintuitively with your service on the Senate Judiciary Committee. I played part of your questioning of the nominee Jennifer Sung to the Ninth Circuit. I would not vote to confirm anyone who signed such a letter. Will you?
No, of course not, Hugh. Jennifer Sung is a far-left lawyer who signed a letter the day after Brett Kavanaugh was nominated. I think she called him intellectually and morally bankrupt and predicted that people will die if he's confirmed. Look, I understand disagreeing with Brett Kavanaugh's rulings when he was a judge and now a justice. I've disagreed with them here and there as well. I've disagreed pretty much every justice's rulings here and there, some a lot more than others, obviously. But I'm not aware why you'd call him morally bankrupt. And Ms. Sung obviously couldn't predict the person or couldn't point to the person who has died in the last 3 years since we confirmed Brett Kavanaugh to the court. I got to say to you, though, that's just the tip of the iceberg. The Biden administration has nominated dozens, maybe hundreds of people whose Twitter feed show them to be totally unhinged. I mean, they really went off the deep end in the Trump era. Some people that I genuinely respected from the Obama era, maybe I didn't agree with them all the time, but I thought, especially in the world of national security, they were responsible, sensible, sober-minded professionals. Even if we had our disagreements here and there about, say, how to confront ISIS or what our policy in Iraq was. And then you look at these guys' Twitter feeds when they come back in front of us to be confirmed this time around, and they sound like crazy people ranting in the streets. I mean, it's just a Jennifer Sung is just a tip of the iceberg for you for this administration.
Well, judicial temperament is a real deal. And the idea that someone would sign a letter with that kind of language in it, there has to be an example made so that people stop sending letters like that, which are unhinged. So my question is, do you think you'll have one Democrat join you? Because you'll need one to stop it, won't you?
We will need one, and that has not been the case on many of these nominations, Hugh. You know, we were able to stop the radical gun grabber who Joe Biden nominated, head of the ATF, because the Democrats couldn't get the votes. But I think that's the only one the Democrats haven't just rolled over on. So, you know, sometimes they talk a big game about being moderates or being independent voices. But so far in this Senate, in this year, the Senate has been a rubber stamp for all of these radical nominees.
All right. Now, I want to go to General Milley. We've played your comments. Former Senator Talent thought they were very judicious. And my position is wait and see. Will you, as a matter of course, on the Senate Intel Committee, be able to read a transcript or hear a recording of the two calls referenced by Woodward and Costa?
Well, Hugh, I don't know about the Intelligence Committee. The Armed Services Committee, I suspect, will be pursuing those. You know, we have Secretary Austin and General Milley coming to testify in just a few days. These are serious reports. General Milley needs to address them. We'll be sure he does address them. At the same time, I don't take on face value everything that Bob Woodward writes. And we could go back through what he's written over his last two books about Donald Trump and a lot of Donald Trump's senior advisors, many of which I know to be inaccurate. So I think General Milley needs to address these reports. But at the same time, I don't think we should take as gospel something just because it appears in Bob Woodward's book.
Now, Admiral Stavridi said he knows the general has a huge respect for his combat record, his bravery, his intellect, his hockey playing at Princeton, et cetera. And I know all that, too, so I am holding judgment. But I had a caller ask this very good question, which hadn't occurred to me. If he spoke disparagingly about the commander-in-chief, would that be cause for removal?
Well, Hugh, I mean, the president of the United States can remove his senior military advisors for any reason or no reason at all. I think that caller's specific question is a question on the Uniform Code of Military Justice. I don't want to play what we call barracks lawyer in the Army on the phone with you right now. But obviously, no military officer should be speaking in public or in private in disparaging tones about the commander-in-chief, whether it's Donald Trump or whether it's Joe Biden.
Especially if you're talking to the counterpart in Chinese communist.
That would be doubly true.
Now, I want to ask you about Afghanistan and Secretary Blinken. Yesterday, Boris Johnson sacked Dominic Raab, doing what ought to have been done by every government involved in this fiasco, taking the political accountability to the highest level, and there may be more coming. Should Tony Blinken be fired?
Hugh, the problem with our Afghanistan debacle is the one person who is most responsible and should be fired is the man at the top, Joe Biden. But Tony Blinken did perform terribly, not just over the last month, but over the last 6 months. I can tell you, without getting into the details, that the CIA was superb in its efforts, not just to save its own people and the Afghans with whom it had worked, but it helped save all those Americans who Tony Blinken's State Department had let down, if not totally abandoned. The military, at the last minute, when it was impressed with 6,000 new troops and a job that it never should have had to do, did that job extraordinarily well, imposing some order on the chaos in the final days of Kabul as they raced to get Americans out of theater. But it was Tony Blinken's State Department that was the lead proponent, once we declared that we were leaving, to make sure that we left in an orderly fashion, that our embassy was able to process everyone who was eligible and vetted for a special immigrant visa, that they were able to leave the country in an orderly fashion. And they did none of that. They didn't surge manpower into the country until the very final days. They didn't declare a non-combatant evacuation operation until Kabul was wide open just a couple days before it fell. They were consistently behind the curve. And the hundreds, really the thousands of Americans, when you include not just citizens and green card holders, but their families, and maybe tens of thousands when you include the special immigrant visa holders that are still in Afghanistan today, are there because of Tony Blinken and the State Department's failures.
Now, Senator, you bring up something that just frustrates me, and I greatly admire, as you know, Governor Romney, Senator Portman. They engaged on the number of LPRs, and Blinken gave the same answer. The secretary said thousands. There was that could be from 2,000 to 999,000. Do you have any idea how many LPRs, green card holders, we left behind?
You know, Hugh, I don't have much better idea than what you saw yesterday, because the Biden administration at this moment still refuses to release that. I sent a letter with 26 other Republicans to Blinken a couple weeks ago demanding that they break down in very precise categories how many citizens are present, how many legal permanent residents are present, how many special immigrant visa holders are present, how many of those people had a special immigrant visa before August 15th. So we're not just including random people that the State Department slapped their name on a visa to try to make it look like they were getting more out. We still haven't heard back from the State Department about that. The State Department will not be getting any nominations approved on fast track until we hear that. But the reason, as you suggested on your show many times, Hugh, is that the Biden administration doesn't want to be held responsible to a baseline number. If they came out and said down to the exact number or within, you know, 25 or 50, they would be held responsible for that. If they just give this wide range of hundreds or thousands, then they can continue to say that we got almost everyone out or got out whoever wants to get out.
Well, that's why the question that ought to be asked by every senator is, give us the minimum number of known citizens, those with whom you've had contact. You must, I'm not holding it to it, there might be more, but what's the minimum number of people from whom you've got emails or phone calls that you are know there in every category? Why doesn't any of your colleague take like evidence 101 or cross-examination 101?
Well, Hugh, I think you saw yesterday in the last 2 days, really, with Blinken in front of the House and the Senate, that even if they had asked that specific question, I don't think Blinken would have answered it. The last thing this administration wants is accountability for the fiasco in Afghanistan, a specific number against which they can be held accountable. They just want the whole thing to disappear. They want to act like it was an extraordinary success, as Joe Biden said, bafflingly, and they want to move on to their reckless and partisan tax and spending bill. So even if you'd had, you know, Perry Mason up there yesterday, I think Tony Blinken would have filibustered and refused to answer, you know. That's why we have checks and balances, Hugh, though, and that's why the State Department is not getting any nominees confirmed anytime soon until they start producing these answers.
Will you be able to ask Secretary Austin and General Milley the minimum number that they are aware of or were aware of at such time as they left Afghanistan? Because I just don't think we have a scale to this problem yet. We don't know how big the disaster is.
We can't ask them that. And they may have some figure, Hugh, but you got to remember they and the intelligence agencies are in support of the State Department when it comes to a non-combatant evacuation. It's the State Department who has that data. It may not be fully shared. And even if the military or the CIA can say, here's the number of minimum contacts we know, that could still just be the tip of the iceberg, because it may be just the people with whom they've worked, whether it's interpreters for the military or some of our partners in counterterrorism operations in Afghanistan for the intelligence world. There may be a whole world of people out there that they have no idea about. The State Department sits at the center of immigrant visa processing. They're the ones that should have all the information.
Very last question. Are you aware of any American special operators retired still operating in Afghanistan, attempting to get people out? Do we still have our heroic veterans running what ought to have been the State Department's mission?
I don't want to comment on where certain Americans may be working this problem from you. I will say that my office has been in contact over the last 6 weeks with a lot of amazing and heroic Americans, veterans of our special operations community, veterans of our intelligence world, who are still working tirelessly to help all those people who are left behind in Afghanistan, who are Americans or green card holders or who helped us through thick and thin, and who they're not willing to surrender to the mercies of the Taliban the way Joe Biden has.
Senator Cotton, you're doing a great job. Thank you. Please keep coming and back, and I hope you get Secretary Blinken in front of you sometime. It just seems to me you know how to ask questions, and I appreciate your questioning of nominee Sung. Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas. Welcome back, America. Alex Michelson has covered the great California recall that wasn't from the beginning. He is, of course, senior political correspondent for Fox 11 in Los Angeles. He also hosts the statewide show, The Question Is, every weekend. Alex, what happened?
Well, the statewide show is called The Issue Is.
The Issue Is. I'm sorry.
The question is, what happened? I think what happened, if you had to put it in a sentence, and I wrote an analysis on this, would be that Governor Newsom changed the question in front of most California voters. It went from, do you think that Governor Newsom is doing a good job, to do you think Larry Elder would be a good governor? And for a state with twice as many Democrats, a state that really, really, really doesn't like President Trump, question two, do you think Larry Elder would be a good governor? They resoundingly said no. They did a lot of different techniques, including making sure there were no other Democrats on the ballot, talking endlessly about Donald Trump, and really focusing on the idea of vaccine mandates and mask mandates, and over and over and over again, getting that in Democrats' minds and having help from national Democratic figures. And they really made this a national partisan race instead of a California issues race.
Now, Alex, Larry won handily, did he not? Question two?
Overwhelmingly, yeah, by like 30-plus points.
And so ought the other contestants to have dropped out and gotten behind him?
There's an argument for that, but who else won handily on question two, which was, you know, question one on the ballot, should the governor be recalled? Question two, who should replace him? The governor told people to leave that question blank, and it appears that like 40% of Californians left it blank.
Wow.
So the Larry Elder number on question two is high. I mean, it's around like 45%, but it's artificially high. If you actually factor in how many Californians didn't vote on that question.
Now, my question, this is looking ahead. Gavin's there. He'll be reelected to Democratic state. Is Larry Elder the de facto head of the California Republican Party now?
He certainly says that he is. And every indication is he is. I mean, who is in place to take him on?
If he goes into a congressional primary after redistricting, and he says, this is my guy or gal, they're going to have a lead, aren't they?
It depends. We don't really have congressional primaries anymore in California. We have a top two system where the top two people get it, which was designed to reward moderates and to hurt extremism. And so we'll see how he would be as a de facto lead of the party. We'll see if he actually runs again. He hasn't.
You know what to look for, Alex? I don't know if he's going to run again. He is going to make a gazillion dollars with a slate mailer. Because if you're on the Larry Elder slate mailer now, you're going to win the jungle primary among Republicans, conservatives, and libertarians. That's what Larry did. He established a focal point. Even though he lost, I know he lost, he established a focal point for assembly candidate for the jungle primary, which has destroyed the Republican Party. I always told my old friend Michael Medved it was a nightmare. Now they've got a de facto designator of the preferred candidate. Don't you agree with that?
Right. But the question is that somebody who can win statewide? And if he's not, what does that mean for the party statewide in a competitive year? Next year is going to be a very competitive midterm year, and California's congressional seats could end up determining whether Republicans get control of the House or not.
Larry's pretty smart. I don't think he'll be out there endorsing crazy people. I think he'll be out there endorsing, under the Buckley rule, the most conservative person who can win. And if he does that, I think the long-term effect is very good for the California Republican Party, because there has been nobody who's been able to point the finger in the jungle primary and say, nominate this person for the main event. And Alex, you know how much money slate mailers make, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, and we should give Larry Elder credit, too. There's been nobody in decades in California politics who has excited the Republican base like Larry Elder has. And he has brought the party together in a very clear way. So to your original question, do you think Larry Elder has captured the heart and soul of the party? There's no doubt that he has. The question is, is there anybody else that could emerge? I think 6 months ago, you would not have thought that Larry Elder would be the one that would emerge, because he said that he wasn't going to be the one that would emerge. He said he would never run. Is there another name out there that could potentially emerge too in the coming months that we're just not thinking about right now?
My last question, Alex, if President Biden doesn't run in 2024, and I can't see him doing so, does Gavin Newsom take on Kamala Harris for the presidential nomination?
You know, they've been frenemies, quote unquote, for years. They've had parallel tracks for their entire career. They have all the same political consultants, a lot of the same friends. Could they take each other on? Who knows? It would be an epic, epic battle. My vote would be probably not, but you never know. I know they both.
You just described Tom Cotton and Mike Pompeo, and they're both running for president, because your time only comes around once. Alex Michelson is the other big winner of the California recall. Follow him on Twitter at Alex, E-L-E-X underscore Michelson. Watch him on Fox 11 in L.A. and tune in. We'll have him back as California continues to evolve. Thanks, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.